Okay, so as I said before, I'm Sid Nagel. I'm over in the James Franck Institute. Let me just start by telling you about some of the research that we've been doing, and it comes under the title The Life and Death of a Drop. And what I'm interested in telling you about are various kinds of transitions that occur in a drop as it goes from its birth to its demise. And all of these transitions and all of the things that come about, I've always found incredibly surprising. And because I find them surprising, then this also leads to trying to understand what the physics is behind these surprises. And so what kind of abrupt shape transitions am I talking about? And so this is one of them. So I'll talk about this in a little bit of detail. But here is a drop on its way to falling. I mean, it's just been hanging there from a plate. And it slowly it drains into this drop. And finally, it gets so heavy that gravity that the surface tension can't hold it up anymore, and gravity just pulls it down. So the question I wanted to ask is, well, how does this drop break apart? And you can see immediately that there's going to be some kind of a problem here. That is, if you look at this neck that is holding this liquid at the bottom and the liquid at the top, you can see that this neck has got to shrink more and more and more until the neck radius goes to zero. If it didn't go to zero, then this drop would still be connected, right? It wouldn't be a disconnected drop. So I have to have that radius actually shrink to zero. But remember that if a radius shrinks to zero, then the curvature is 1 over the radius, and so that's getting infinitely large. As the radius goes to zero, the curvature is diverging. But what is the forces on this drop? Well, the one thing we know about liquids is that there's a difference in the pressure inside to that outside. The pressure difference is proportional to this thing called surface tension times the curvature. Now, the surface tension is something that you're familiar with. That if you take a drop of liquid, it's the surface tension which tries to make this thing into a sphere. It tries to minimize the surface area, keeping the volume fixed. And so you pay an energy cost if there is extra surface area, so you try to minimize that. And so it's that surface tension, that common thing that you know, times the curvature here, which gives me the pressure difference right here. But the curvature is diverging, so that means the pressure is diverging there. That means I'm getting infinite forcing at this point, just as this thing tries to break apart. So how do I try to understand this problem? So I have this drop, we know the equations that govern this. These are the Navier-Stokes equations. They're ugly equations. They're basically just Newton's laws, but for a liquid. And so you put them onto a computer, and you can't solve them analytically, so you put them on the computer, and you solve it at some point, and then you iterate farther, and you get a little bit closer to the breakup point. And so you say, well, that's not close enough. I want to get closer. And so you work a lot harder to get a little bit closer. And you notice you have to work harder because you still have to resolve this big thing here. And now you've got to resolve these smaller and smaller scales as you go in. And so, but you say, I want farther. And so you work harder and you get closer. You work harder and you get closer. But you never get to the other side of the singularity. It's Zeno's paradox all over again. No matter how hard you work, you only get closer to this transition. You never get to the other side. And so there are computers all over the world, you know, trying to figure this out. But then you just look out your window and you see this drop hanging from the eave of your house, and it just falls. It doesn't try to figure out, well, how do I fall? It just does it. And this means that there's something about the physics of this that we don't really understand. That is, we don't know how to make it happen in a computer, yet nature does it all the time. So this is one example of a singularity in fluids. Singularities appear at lots of other places, too, in physics, everywhere. And so this is an example that we get to study very cleanly in a controlled environment on a tabletop. We get to do careful experiments. We get to do careful simulations. And we get to do theory all together to try and understand this, the nature of this kind of singularity, which will then be applicable to singularities in all sorts of other places. So I told you that this is going to be the life history of a drop. So there's a birth and childhood. And so here is the birth of this drop. And it's just hanging from this plate. And, you know, it's a happy childhood. I mean, it's just sitting there. And you can ask, well, what kind of liquid is this? And you can't tell. Because, as within all babies, I mean, they're kind of all look the same, right? And that's the same here. All these drops look basically the same because they are just a balance of two forces. One is gravity pulling this thing down, and the other is surface tension trying to hold this thing up. And so it hasn't started to move, and so as long as it's not moving, none of the other properties of the fluid come into this. And so this thing is just hanging there, ready to start to move. And so slowly it gets filled and it starts to get unstable. So then you get to the teenage years. And so what are the teenage years for a drop? Well, you have this long neck that starts to form, or it gets pulled out. And the question I have for you now is, if you have a long cylinder of fluid, is that cylinder going to be stable? Well, you already know that I told you that the surface tension is going to try and make this thing into a sphere, right? I mean, that's what I told you to begin with. That's what surface tension does. But I'm not going to let that happen. I'm going to make sure that the cylinder is held at its two ends, so it can't shrink in this direction. And now I'm going to ask, okay, given that cylinder of fluid, is that cylinder of fluid going to be stable? And so the way you would answer that is to say, okay, if I put any perturbation on this fluid, on that shape, will that shape be more energetically favorable or less energy favorable? And all I have to do to calculate that is find out, well, what is the surface area of this object versus this object? This is the perturbed object versus the original object. So the original object, I don't know if you can understand the drawing I have, so let me try and describe it. Is I just had the cylinder, and now the problem is I'm going to try to perturb this, so I have to keep the volume the same, but I'm going to perturb it, so I'm going to put a little bit bigger at the ends and a little bit smaller in the middle. So it's going to be something that looks like this. Okay? Is that clear what I'm doing? So, but it's just a tiny little perturbation, and I just want to ask, okay, with that tiny little perturbation, did I increase or decrease the surface area? It's just a calculus problem. And when you do that, you find out that, well, actually, this decreases the surface area if the length of this cylinder is greater than the original circumference of that cylinder. Okay, so this thing then, if it's long enough, this thing becomes unstable. And then this has a greater curvature here, so that's actually forcing more fluid out. And so this feeds on itself, and this thing is going to try to squeeze off in the center, pushing fluid out to the two ends. So this is one of the classic instabilities of fluid dynamics. It's the Rayleigh plateau instability. And it's something that you can see fairly easily. So if you take your fingers and stick it into your mouth and get some spit on it, and now I'll hold it up and look at it. Okay. Tonight, when you go home, go into the bathroom, lock the door so no one can see you do this. And then when no one's looking, stick your fingers in your mouth, put some spit on it, and then spread your fingers apart and look at the little cylinder of fluid between your two fingers, and you will see that you have a thin thread, and then there's going to be a little ball of stuff in the middle of this. Right? That's a Rayleigh plateau instability. Now, I'm not sure why you're so shy in doing this. I did it in front of all of you, and I'm the professor. I mean, I'm not supposed to do that kind of stuff. But But you're too shy. So please do that tonight and make sure that you can see it yourself. But I thought you'd be shy, so I have a picture of what you should have seen. Okay, so this picture is a picture of a spider. It's called a bolus spider. And so it doesn't build a web. What it does is it takes its stuff and it sees a fly and it winds this up and catches a fly in the stuff. And then it does what the spiders usually do to flies, which we don't need to go into. But what I wanted you, the excuse to show this to you was look at this long tendril of fluid hanging from the spider's leg. It's not a simple cylinder. It's got all this bulginess all up and down it. That's the Rayleigh plateau instability. When there used to be warmth outside and there was dew on the grass and you come out in the morning and you see a spider's web, there again you can see it because there instead of having the dew everywhere along the spider's web, you see little drops at different points on the spider's web. Those decorations, that's again the fact that the dew was everywhere to begin with, but then it becomes unstable and it forms into these drops along the web. Okay, so this was how this thing first starts to fall apart. It's but then, of course, it reaches its midlife crisis. Right? So this is the midlife crisis of the drop. And so what have I done here? I've shown you two pictures here of the drop where it's reached a crossroads. It's got to change. It's got to do something. And what it's going to do is it's going to break apart. And so what do we see here? Well, we see the circular region here, and we see this cone pointing into it, and we see the same thing over here. And they seem to, you know, I seem to have two pictures of the same thing. But what I'm going to do now is I've actually covered up the rest of these pictures, and now I'm going to uncover them. And so I'm going to take away those things so you can see what these pictures were of. And what you can see is, well, this was the region that I had kind of shown you before in that other picture. But this region was this thing turned upside down. I had inverted that image and just shown you this little region. So if I go back, you can see that that's what I'd shown you. And now this is the stuff uncovered. And they look identical. I couldn't tell them apart. But if you look at where this really came from, it was actually this picture flipped. And so what we have was we have the cone here of fluid pointing into the sphere here, and we have this cone up here pointing into that sphere up on top. And gravity is always pointing down in both of them. So here the instability, how this thing has gone unstable and broken apart, looks the same even though gravity is pointing in different directions. According to, that is, in this case it's pointing along the cone, and this case is pointing in the opposite direction to that cone. So something has changed, and what you see is that change didn't do anything to the way this the singularity or this breakup event occurred. So what this gives you a little hint of is the fact that, oh, something about this may indeed be universal, that there's going to be something universal about how we're going to treat these regions where this breakup takes place. And so that's what I want to talk about. And it's the midlife crisis, and so all these drops are unhappy, and they're all unhappy in their own way. And so what I've shown you here are four different images of a drop in the process of breaking apart. This is the one that you've seen already several times. This is just water falling in air, and what you see is that cone region here pointing into the sphere. What's this image? This image is of a more viscous fluid. It's just water mixed with something called glycerol. Anyone know what glycerol is? It's something that is very very polar, just like water. It's a fluid that you can buy at the grocery store to put into soap bubbles to make bigger and stronger soap bubbles. Right? So this is this more viscous water falling in air. And notice that this has changed dramatically. This came down to this point here, this long, long, thin cylinder, which is almost the same size everywhere, suddenly seems to go unstable, and it forms this very thin thread connecting these two regions. If I had taken this picture a little bit later, this little thread would have broken up into smaller threads. This image here is of a viscous fluid. This is glycerol on the inside, and on the outside, it's not air anymore, but it's an oil. And so no one said that it had to break apart just in air, but now it's breaking apart in an outer fluid, in oil. And now you see that the cone is pointing down, but there's also a wider cone pointing up in this region. And then finally, if I look at this one, this is just water inside a very viscous outer fluid. And those of you in the front row, I hope, can see. I don't know if those of you in the back can, but it's still connected here by this tiny, thin, thin, thin little thread connecting these two. And that's how nature has decided to break this drop apart. Why it chose this way to break it apart, I have no idea, but it's amazing that this is how nature thought to break it apart. All of this is very different from my initial conception of how does a drop break apart. Well, it just has this neck that gets thinner and thinner and thinner until they just touch, and then I get this kind of tear-shaped drop that that's a cartoon that we all think of when we think of it, and none of this looks that way at all. It's all exceedingly different from that. So as an experimentalist, what do I get to do? I get to vary various things in here to tune myself into these different regions. What do I tune? Well, I can tune the inner viscosity of the fluid's inner viscosity here. I can tune the outer viscosity here. So this was air, but this was a very viscous fluid on the outside. I can vary the densities of these two fluids. I can vary the surface tension between the two fluids, and I can vary the nozzle diameter. And these are the parameters that I get to change as an experimentalist to go into one region or another and try to look for the different classes of behavior that I was able to show here. Okay, so now I want to say, so how do you think about these shapes? And there's one idea here which is kind of a key, important idea, and I hope I can try and get this across in a simple way. And this is the idea of scale invariance in this. And you see this appearing in many different guises in physics as well. So I was at great pains to tell you at the breakup point, the radius of that neck as it gets smaller and smaller and smaller is getting smaller than any other length scale in the problem. Okay? Does it smaller than the diameter? It's smaller than the radius at which the surface tension and gravity compete, or where viscosity and surface tension compete. It gets smaller than anything because it's going to zero. Now, I'm not thinking of this in terms of what's happening at the atomic scale. I'm thinking about this in the hydrodynamic scale, in which I'm still thinking of this as a continuum. Okay, so it's getting smaller than any other length scale, but then what that implies to me is, well, the dynamics then doesn't care about those other length scales anymore. And so the flow only depends on that shrinking radius. Now, why would I say something like that? So think of a rain falling on a mountainside. The rain falls on the mountainside. It collects into brooks, rivers, and finally gets into the mighty river that crosses the continent. And then it gets to the delta at the outlet of that river. And there, the river breaks up into smaller rivers, brooks, streams, rivulets, and finally it flows between two little pebbles in the stream. And my question to you is, does the way the water flows between those two little pebbles in the stream depend on the fact that the water originally came from rain on a mountainside? no, that doesn't sound reasonable, right? It shouldn't depend on that anymore. I've forgotten all that information. All that matters is how close are those two little pebbles in the stream. It's that scale is the only scale that matters anymore. So that's what I'm using here. That's a guess. Now, it's a guess, and you're going to have to check whether that guess is right. I mean, no one said it had to be, but that was the intuition behind the guess that I told you. And so now the flow only depends on the shrinking radius of that neck. But what did that shrinking radius depend on? It depended on the flow, which depends on the radius, which depends on the flow, which depends on the radius, flow, radius, flow, radius, flow, radius, flow, radius, all the way down. So what do I have here? I've constructed for you a fractal sentence. I take any part of the sentence and I blow it back up and I get the original sentence back, right? It just keeps going. And this is a nice analogy with the mathematics that's involved in this. That you're getting self-similar structure near this critical point where this thing is breaking apart. And so this is the reason why you can get these universal shapes, because there's only one, the length scale has dropped out of this because it doesn't depend on any length scale anymore. It's a self-similar structure that you continue to get. And so this was where we started. This is what we first showed was the right way to look at some of these situations. But now I want to show you a case where you really do have to check all of your assumptions. So this is the image that you've seen over and over again, a drop falling in air. This is exactly the opposite. What do I mean by the opposite? So I just reverse the two fluids. So this is air on the inside, and this is water on the outside. This was water on the inside, air on the outside. So I've just reversed the two fluids. So this was water falling down. This is going to be air rising in this fluid. Okay, so now I want to see what this looks like. And so this was a very carefully done experiment where it was very carefully leveled, very nice circular orifice for this tube coming out. And now we can watch how this movie goes, gets thinner, breaks apart. It goes through all of this, and it's watching this in real time, it's a beautiful type of thing to watch. But I emphasized how carefully this experiment was done. I didn't do that for the other ones. I just showed you what the pictures were. Why do I emphasize it here? Because this one now depends very much on how I started out the experiment. So that was a very carefully leveled circular nozzle in which the air was then let out a little bit at a time until it formed this bubble and then it broke. And I had to do that very carefully, and that kept it looking in the pristine fashion that you saw. But now if we do the experiment where I let it out through a slot nozzle. Instead of a circular nozzle, I make it in the form of a slot. Then we can see what happens. And now this is just looking at the neck region, and this is what this thing looks like. This has lost all of that beautiful symmetry that we had in all of those other images. If I play it again, what does this look like? If anything, this looks like a piece of paper being torn in part rather than a fluid breaking it apart on its own. So you've got events coming on one side or the other side. They're going in and trying to break this thing apart. And it looks like tearing, but remember, this is nothing more than water and air, two things which I can't think of less likely to have it look like tearing. Okay, and so something very different has happened here. And this is a breakdown of that assumption that you all nodded, yes, it shouldn't matter anymore whether the flow is between two pebbles in the stream. That's a very good assumption. That's what we all believed until we saw this experiment. When we did this experiment, it was such that, showed you this image and, you know, this one really looks good, but the student who was doing this, you know, kept showing these things to me and, you know, and they always didn't look quite so good. And finally I asked, well, how come these things don't look quite so nice? He said, yes, I'm terribly sorry, Professor. I'm terribly sorry that, you know, but, you know, I just can't make it look so so clean. And so I've been trying to only give you the ones that really show how nice and symmetric this is. And that was the whole point. That it was not clean. It was not symmetric. Something was breaking that symmetry. And that was what nature was telling us. And only when we worked very hard to make it different so that we could see how clean this thing could be, were we able to get away from that. But the generic thing was this very different type of behavior. And so that's the point of this. That is, there are various ways in which this drop can break apart. And so, just like in life, there's nature versus nurture. So what do I mean by nature? Well, if it's nature, you lose your identity. It doesn't matter how you're raised. You always evolve to the singularity that depends on the material, but not on anything about your memory of how you were raised or what happened to you earlier on in life. That was the first set of things that I told you about. This last one of the air bubble rising is nurture, where that's important because now you're struggling to retain identity. That is, you're remembering everything about your past, and everything about your past is what determines the evolution to that singularity point. And so this is shows the different kinds of phenomena that you can get in just in looking at this kind of drop breakoff event. So this is all I want to tell you about breakup, but I mean this is not the end of the life of a drop. I mean, so you know, this is midlife crisis, and after a midlife crisis, what do? You're in free fall, right? You don't know what's going on, so you just it's a mess. And so in this case, it really is free fall. This drop is just coming down, and it's going to hit something, and when it hits something, it's going to splash. And so the question is, what is the physics of splashing? And so what I want to show you now is just a movie of a drop splashing. Okay. So this is a drop of alcohol. It's about 3.5 millimeters in diameter. This white thing in the center is not something inside the drop. Just remember this alcohol, like water, is nice and transparent, and so we're lighting it from behind. And so all this white thing is basically an image of the light in back of it. It's kind of like a lens. Okay. So it's falling from roughly this height, and so it's going to hit the surface at a few meters per second. This surface here is a smooth, dry glass microscope slide. As this comes down, you're going to see its reflection in that slide. So let's see what this looks like. So it's a rather beautiful thing, isn't it? I mean, it comes down, it hits, and as soon as it hits, it forms this corona, which then spreads out, and that corona then breaks up. It's so nice, I like to watch it again, so you'll watch it again. Yeah. No, a hydraulic jump is a different hydrodynamic thing. So there, a hydraulic jump is where if you go to a kitchen sink, nice flat surface, and you have a jet of liquid coming into that sink, it starts to move outwards versus the side. And so what you see there is that there's a very thin layer, and then suddenly it gets thick. It's not that it's jumping up, it just gets thicker. And so what's happening there is that no perturbation from outside can get in because there's a flow out and any information of trying to flow back in is impeded by this flow. So no information can get back in. So it's a fluid dynamic black hole. Okay, so, but that's not what this is. This is just a splash. And so we're going to watch this again. And so watch this thing as it hits. And as it hits, it suddenly forms this corona, which spreads and breaks up. Kind of neat. Okay, so what's important for creating a splash? Well, look, certain things you can certainly think of. Well, there's the size of this drop and how fast it's falling. Because if I took a tiny, tiny little drop and placed it very carefully on a plate, you know that would not splash. You'd be able to place it down there without splashing. So size and velocity matter. Also, that surface tension, that thing that was trying to hold this thing together, must matter. And also, how easy this thing is to flow, that is, its viscosity, must matter. And so that now I've talked about all the properties of the liquid, and now there's a substrate. And so is it a smooth substrate? Is it a rough substrate? Is it wet or is it dry? Is it soft or is it hard? And now I've basically said everything about the substrate. And now that should be everything in the problem. But the thing I didn't mention was, how about the air? Well, it's obvious the air doesn't matter, right? I mean, I don't feel the air. I mean, it's hardly there. The last time you felt any air you were worried about the air was when you were running upstairs and you were out of breath, not because you felt the air in your face, right? So at these scales, air shouldn't matter. But you do know that if you stick your hand out a moving car window, the window of a moving car, you'll see feel a lot of drag on your hand as it's being pushed back. So you think, well, maybe the air in here is impeding these little droplets trying to get away. And so if I took some of that air out, I would get an enormous splash. I would get something really worth the word, right? I mean, so that's what we tried to do. We tried to see whether we could get a really big splash. And so here it is at atmospheric pressure. This is the third time you've seen this movie. So it's the same movie you've seen. It hits and expands and forms a corona and breaks apart. And now I'm going to do exactly the same experiment. It's the same alcohol, the same diameter, falling from the same height, hitting the same smooth dry glass microscope slide. Everything is the same, except that we've done it in a container where we can take out some of the air. I haven't taken out so much air. It's only one-third of atmospheric pressure. So this is the air pressure that you would get at the top of Mount Everest. You could live there. You wouldn't be happy, but you could live in this thing, right? And so that's the kind of air pressure we're at. And now I'm doing exactly the same experiment, and I'm expecting to get a really big, dramatic splash. And so let's watch this dramatic splash. So here it comes. It's going to hit. Splash. So in the words of Ayarabi, who ordered that? I mean, 3 months later, we finally picked ourselves up off the floor after laughing so hard. I mean, this was not supposed to happen. Right. Everything I just told you was indeed the way one would think that splashing should occur. Air shouldn't matter. And people have been studying splashing using photography since the time of Worthington in 1900, when photography was only 50 years old, and they were still trying to take pictures back then. And all that time, no one had thought to take the air out because it was obviously a stupid thing to do. And yet, if you take the air out, you find that that completely suppresses splashing. That is, it has the air really is a control parameter for this. It's not some small perturbation. It's the control parameter for what. If you didn't have air, you would not get any splashing. So, what happens if you look at this at a higher viscosity? So I did this with water, with alcohol, which is kind of like water. Now I'm going to go to 10 times the the viscosity. And again, this is at atmospheric pressure. And now I'm going to let this thing splash. So it's the same experiment over and over again. And it just spreads out, right? Nothing's going to happen. Right? So let's just finish this. Oh, maybe something did happen after all. So this is the way this drop splashes. That is, it doesn't create this corona that goes up, but it creates a thin sheet that comes out very parallel to the surface. And that's what then breaks apart and gives rise to the splash. So this is looks like a different kind of splashing. So we can look and ask, well, suppose we took the air out, would this kind of splashing go away? And the answer is, yes, it goes away. That is, again, the air is the control parameter. It's not this minor thing. Okay, so the same thing happens even though the morphology of this drop, the shape, has changed dramatically. So what do we try to do? And so, you know, what is our lab trying to do? I mean, so we made this discovery a few years ago, and we are stuck. We have been trying to figure out, so why does air matter? I mean, everything I told you was not a lie. I mean, that was all, you know, is our intuition, but also, you know, you try to look at it, and look, air is 1,000 times less dense than the liquid. It's 1,000 times less dense than the solid that the drop is going to hit. So how could this air, which can actually also move out of the way, play such a dramatic effect? And so it's got to be some small thing that's going on, but which then creates, I mean, you've got to figure out why it doesn't depend on the big forces in the problem, but it depends on the very little forces. So one of the ways to attack this, we've tried various means, but one thing is to ask, okay, so where does the air matter? Is it underneath the drop where this thing is falling? And so we've looked at that using interference imaging to try and find that out, and no, the air underneath there is not doing anything at the time this thing tries to eject this thin sheet and splash. So we're now going to visualize the air above the drop, and this is using a technique called Schlieren imaging. Schlieren imaging is where you try to enhance the contrast due to very small changes of index of refraction. So if you go to a hot summer day on at an airport and look at the tarmac, you see that the air is all shimmery and it's moving around. That's because it's really hot down there, and what you're seeing is the plumes of the heat moving, but what you're seeing is small changes in the index of refraction due to the density of the air in these various places. So that's what we're going to be picking up here. This thing here is just the drop falling, and that's pure black, and so that's not the interesting part in here. This is a substrate, which is pure black. That's not the interesting part. What I want you to look at is what's happening in all the gray region around this. So here is, now we're trying to look at visualizing the air, what the air is doing above this drop. So there's a lot going on up above that drop. I mean, so this was the drop. All of this gray stuff, that's the air that we're visualizing with the small changes of index of refraction as it goes on. So I could show it again. What you'll see is, as this comes down, you'll see two trails behind. That's the wake of this drop falling down that you see in the air. And then you see the rest of this moving out. And so this is all the air as that starts to then curl around, and you get these vortex lines moving in this, forming and then detaching from this spreading liquid. So this is, you know, one of the types of things that we look at is to try and figure out, okay, so where is the air mattering? Is it the air below? Is it the air above? Is it the air right in front of this drop? So beautiful as this these images are, I don't think that that's where the air matters for the drop. We thought for a while that maybe these vortex rings could help lift up that sheet, but we don't think that that's the thing. What we think it's really what's happening at the front of the drop, which is where the forces go. The forces there are what's those little forces there are what's needed to bring this thing and raise the drop so you can get the thin sheet formation. Okay, so this is the end of what I want to say about the splashing. Okay, so we and you might think that this is the end of the life story of the drop, right? Because we started with a baby, it had the teenage years, it then went through a midlife crisis, broke apart, then it was in free fall and smashed against something, and after it smashed against something, then you think that that's the end of life for this drop. Well, maybe it is, but as in real life, you know, life doesn't really end with death. It ends with when the memory of the person is gone. And so that's what I want to think of here. So what do I mean by that in this case? So what is the memory of this drop? And so once this drop has landed on, let's say, a nice substrate, a surface, and let's say it was a drop of coffee. So this is a surface, and the coffee forms a little dome. It's a little top of a sphere at the top of this. That's what's on top of the surface. And you think about this for a second, and you say, well, okay, it's thicker here in the middle than it is near the edge. So if it's thicker near the middle, when this thing has evaporated, where is all the coffee stain going to be? Well, it should be in the middle, right? That's where it is. But then I ask you, well, have you ever seen a coffee stain which is thicker in the middle and thinner along the edge? And this is something that, look, you've all seen this hundreds of thousands of times in your life. Every one of us has. Everyone in the world has seen this. And yet no one had ever stopped to ask, okay, so, hey, this doesn't make sense. I mean, it's supposed to be thicker in the middle, but somehow it always goes to the edge. The drops are always ring-shaped. They always have all of the stuff that they're carrying, the solute, going out to the edge of that drop. And so for those of you who don't remember, I've got some pictures of, took some pictures of drops, but these should look more or less familiar. So these are just four coffee drops placed down, and you can see, yes, it's light in the center and a dark ring of coffee around the edges of this. Here, I had a bunch of drops, and I just pulled out little tails, so I got little tadpoles, and at the end of the drying process, there was hardly anything in the middle, but all of the stuff went out into these tails and around the edge and into the tails. And then this drop was a big floppy thing. It was just a big drop. I didn't know what to do with it. So I just took a straw and pulled out little tendrils. I couldn't even see them when I made them. It was so light. But yet when this thing dried, look where all of the darkness was. It all went out into this sun-shaped object. So all of the solute ended up there. So why did that happen? And another question is that an important thing to have happened? You know, if it only happened with coffee, well, maybe it would be only interesting to me and a few other diehard coffee drinkers. But it happens with everything. So it happens, you know, with water-based things, oil-based things, alcohol-based things. It happens with molecular size things inside. So when you, in this winter, you're going to have salt on the street, coming in with wet boots with salt on it, you're going to drip on the linoleum. What's that stain going to look like? It's all just, the salt is just mixed in with the water, but as this thing dries, what you're going to find out is that you have white stain around the edge of this stain, not in the center. So that's, again, the same thing, but happening at a very different scale. When you paint your garage and you it's oil-based and you have this big, thick stuff and you leave a drop, the drop at the beginning forms a hemisphere and it doesn't look so bad. But after you let this thing dry, there's always that little dimple in the center of the hemisphere, for those of you who remember that. Ugly. You say, I should have brushed that out. It's the same thing. The stuff is trying to get to the edge as much as it can. And so this is how I was going to make my money. I was going to create the coffee stain font. And it's a beautiful font, I think. Look, I mean, every letter is nicely outlined in coffee. And if Maxwell House only knew what they were missing, they would have bought this. But it's really a kind of a beautiful thing. And you can see that there's a lot of physics in here. That is, it gets darker around the edge, where it's the curvature is large, and where the curvature is in the opposite direction, it gets very light. So there's a dynamic going on here, which is, this is the kind of thing that needs to be understood. So what's happening in this? And so, at the end, it's a very simple explanation, which I can tell you fairly quickly. The problem was that it was hard to find out what was the right explanation. And why was it hard? Because this effect was so robust. We couldn't make it disappear. If you can't make an effect disappear, there's no way I can control it, so there's no way to test anything. And it was only because there was an undergraduate in our lab who looked at this, and what she did was she covered everything in the drop except for a little hole in the center. So that's the only way the air could escape, the water vapor could escape. And that was how we finally found out, is how the evaporation takes place from in the air that matters. And so the effect is simple. So what is the effect? That is, here's the substrate. This blue line is the drop. There are two things that you should know about this. One is that it's going to evaporate, which means there's going to be water or whatever evaporates into the air. And then once it's there, then it's going to do a random walk to get out to infinity eventually, move far enough away. Okay, so that's obvious. It has to leave something else behind, otherwise it wouldn't be any stain whatsoever. The other thing is that you have these two points where this drop comes down and makes contact with the surface. And as this dries, what's going to happen? Is it going to be that everything shrinks in to nothing? Or is it that those two points are fixed and just the height decreases in time? Now, we're kind of taught in class that the important thing is that this angle remain fixed. And that's Young's angle for evaporation or for liquid contact line. But if you look at what happens in a real drop, that's not what happens. These contact points are pinned, and they do not move in. So as this thing evaporates, my elbows are the points on the contact. They remain fixed, and the height just decreases and decreases and decreases. So what does that mean? That means that if I have this blue line, which is the initial drop, and I evaporate a layer of water from that surface, I go from this dark blue line to the dashed blue line. But what does that do? That has now moved this contact line from out here inside here. And I just told you that cannot happen. So what really has to happen is I have to get the red line. So it goes from the blue to the red. What that means is that this dashed blue line can't be the right thing. What it had to do was it had to have some extra flow from the center outside to fill in that gap. So another way of saying that is any time there's any evaporation at all from the edge here, It has to be replenished by a flow from the inside. And that flow from the inside is just taking all this material and bringing it out to the edge. And so that's the basic phenomena of what's happening.
Sorry, so to clarify, the way you made the effect disappear was by only allowing it to evaporate from the center, so that we don't have that.
That's right. So I don't get any evaporation from the edge, just get evaporation from the center, and then we got just a smudge in the middle and nothing out at the edge. So, yeah. Okay, so that's a good question. So it isn't, it's a slightly different question. You can check that this is the right thing that happens just by looking at a stain and just making sure that the contact line doesn't move in, right? And so, but one way of saying it is that, okay, so if this is the substrate and I have a little bit of roughness on the substrate, so let's say I had a little bit of a little blip there, micron size, really small. And we say, yes, indeed, you need to have the right angle, Young's angle. Well, what that means is that if the Young's angle is right at that point of the drop, and then I lose surface, I lose volume, this thing can move over, but without changing without changing the surface angle right at the piece of roughness, so it only moves on the order of a micron, and yet the whole the whole drop has lost a lot of the volume during that. So it's because so one way of explaining it is because you have little bits of surface roughness, and the surface roughness then you can accommodate lots of angles without moving laterally very far across that surface roughness.
Would we eliminate the effect of that ring on the outside because the drop would shrink just at a uniform rate that would also contract its volume to meet that sort of tendency towards a sphere?
Yeah, so
sort of form like that?
Yeah, okay. So look, there are, this is by far the most common type of thing that I've just described to you. But there are other kinds of interactions of a drop with the surface. And you're describing one of the other two. So one is where this thing is totally non-wetting. And so if you have mercury on a table, it doesn't touch the table. It tries to ball, make itself into a tiny little ball and only touch the table at one point. And so all of this stuff leaves, goes away, and there's no contact line for anything to form at. And so I think that was the one that you were asking. There's another. And so you're absolutely right. That is nothing. You won't see a stain in that case because there was no contact line. It was basically being held up by just one point. The other case is where this thing is so likes the surface so much that it wets everything uniformly. So it just loves the surface, and there is no angle at all. The angle is zero. In that case, so that would be like water on mica. And there, it becomes more complicated. So if there were things in the water at some point would pin as the stuff finally starts to retract, and it gets hung up by those little pieces of dirt, which is what's going to form the ring. And so it gets hung up by those things, and because it's hung up, more dirt falls into that ring, and so it builds on itself. So it does it by itself. It forms that pinning by itself. But the pinning isn't as strong, and so every once in a while it jumps over that barrier, and so what you get is a beautiful lace-like pattern. So if you look at, water with colloids in it on a mica substrate and just watch what happens, there's it's a beautiful set of things that you can get because you have this competition of the pinning and the jumping over the pinning, the self-pinning, and then the jumping over the pinning of the liquid. So there are other things, but this is kind of the generic garden variety thing. That the thing I should just say, this is if you try to ask, well, what is the physics here? There's a strict analogy between the equations that govern this and the equations that govern a lightning rod. So it's just the fact that at the when it comes down to this edge here, that is also a singularity, much like the other singularity I talked about. And at a singularity, the electric field is infinite. That's what you that's why the lightning rods have these very sharp points, because you want a sharp point, and so you have a very strong field there. It's the same kind of thing here. So there's a it's one of these beautiful things where you work in one subject and you see this analogy to something else that you've seen all along. And so there are these different ways of looking. So I think that's really basically bringing me to the end of this story of the drop. So that was the memory of the drop and where it fades. And what I guess I hope you've seen is that there's a lot of things that happen in the life of a drop. They are astonishing, and they're subtle. But at least in some cases, we've been able to find the tools to decipher their codes. And what you should see is, as I was just saying about these singularities here and the singularities earlier, there are similar concepts, these ideas of scaling, which come in over and over again in these different kinds of problems. And so this is this quote by the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, that a great idea, in this case it's the ideas of scaling that have been developed over the years, a great idea is like a phantom ocean beating upon the shores of human life in successive waves of specialization. And I think that really expresses some of this. Each of these were different bits of physics, different ways of looking at the world, and each of them somehow makes use of the same ideas as the same kind of waves coming and hitting you over and over again. And so with that, that's the end. And these are all the people who actually did all the work. So these are various students. Wendy Zhang, some of you may know. Tom Witten, some of you may know. Do you know any of the other professors here? Todd, I don't know if any of you know Todd over in the computer science department. And then these are graduate students and the undergraduate who did the work on the coffee stain, and postdoc who did the work on seeing the vortices above the drop in the air above the drop. Okay, that's basically what I have to tell you tonight. Thanks.